Hey, Gisters. Welcome to the Gist podcast number 9. This is Emily Steinmark, and I'm here with Josh Marsh and Barry Robertson. Today, we're exploring how and why some people spend time and money on communicating science. Of course, we could talk for hours about why we communicate science, but we thought it was time to put on our critical hats and ask some hard questions. And so, we got in touch with the experts.
And as it turns out, Glasgow is full of science communicators. We have an excellent branch of Café Scientifique, we have the Glasgow Science Centre, Glasgow Skeptics, Bright Club, and of course, the man who is the glue of all things SciCommie, Glasgow University Public Engagement Officer Jamie Gallagher. And dear listeners, we'll be chatting to all of them.
Because we care about you.
Precisely. Now, to get the ball rolling, we're starting at the event that kicked off our recent Science Bite podcast series, Explorathon, a huge undertaking that put thousands of members of the general public in direct contact with the researchers at their local universities.
Explorathon is in many ways a dream project for the science communicator. Big show, good headlines, large audience. But where the individual science communicator might feel motivated by a mix of wanting to share the love for their subject, wanting to educate, maybe even wanting to influence, Explorathon was thought out with a specific goal in mind. Jamie Gallagher, the main man behind Glasgow's Explorathon event, explains.
So before we even started with the planning of events, we were working out what do people think of researchers and what do people think of research. So we actually did a baseline survey. We phoned around people in Scotland and asked them what they thought of researchers. So that was our starting goal. And then we thought we would try and challenge some of those misconceptions that researchers are boring or research isn't relevant and who does research. So we set out to provide an exciting and fun event where people could get hands-on with research, where people could just work out what goes on inside the universities in the city. So they see them up on the hill, you know, the distinctive tower, but what goes on there? And it was about throwing the doors open and saying, this is what we do, this is what we spend, you know, your money on, and seeing how they can benefit from research that happens. I think one of our draws for Explorathon was we had a welcome message from the International Space Station, and I think even people that don't have much of a day-to-day interest in science, there's certain things like that that captures people's imaginations. You know, the idea that these people are up there orbiting around the Earth, getting a message from them, that's quite exciting. Even to get into the Science Centre for free is something that a lot of people don't get a chance to do. You know, it's like £10 a ticket for an adult, so by giving them that kind of existing setup, something quite exciting, that was kind of a lure to draw them in, where our researchers could welcome them and take them through some of the research. So I think you didn't have to be necessarily interested in what was going on at the university. There was other draws as well to bring people in.
So an active attempt to demythicise researchers, and maybe in particular scientists, but while using showstoppers like the International Space Station, which you'll have to admit is quite far from what most earthbound researchers do on a day-to-day basis. In reality, maybe we need this contradiction to on one hand draw in people and excite their imagination, while on the other hand making them take a bit of ownership of research and take it seriously in relation to their own lives. Okay, but so, for example, one of the researchers from Explorathon that we talked to, Fiona, she does very specific things about glucose molecules and, like, metabolism and things that might be quite difficult to send out with, like, this is what we do and this is why it's interesting and this is why it's important for the person on the street. So is that kind of one of the things that you have to go in and figure out how we put that out to people?
Definitely. There's some topics that are much more instantly sellable than others. There are some topics we discover and BBC will want to roll in and film it there and then because it's exciting, it could be a documentary. Other topics are more difficult. But all topics are being researched for a reason. So you take a step back from the research. You think the research is maybe about making something more efficient. So something the research works so a route to a new synthetic molecule is 1% more efficient, and that's of interest to the scientific community. That's not of interest to the general community. So you take a step back and work out, if I've produced a 1% greater efficiency, what does that mean? Maybe it means that an industry saves a lot of money. Maybe it means that people are diagnosed or treated for an illness a little bit quicker. And so working out why on a fundamental reason that research is being done and then getting that message out there. So sharing that, why, who's going to be affected by the research? Because someone will be. The research is being done for a reason, and working out what groups are affected by it and taking it to them.
Perspective is what people need to relate to scientific research, from both the grand and spectacular space stations and from the niche, small detail science put into a larger context. But so, if we're so desperate to talk to the public and look them in the eye, what is their role? Is it just a showman's need for an audience? Again, being public engagement officer, this is Jamie's bread and butter.
One area, one big area that generating impact happens is in sharing your work and making an influence to people outside of the university. And that's kind of where I fit in. I try and help the academics get their work outside of universities and try and make sure that when they're interacting with the public, it's not just about telling them what they've done, it's about making sure it's a kind of two-way process, that the public get a chance to feed into the work that we're doing, that there's a benefit, there's a change developed from the work that we're doing. And academics are very good and very experienced at doing research, but all of a sudden the shift towards opening doors and selling everything to the public is quite a shift. So I spent a lot of time working with the public doing science communication, and I can help the academics, so from a very heavy research background, help them translate their work and get it out there.
A reciprocal relationship between research and the public. Very interesting. If only there was an even clearer example of this. Over to you, Barry.
Thanks, Emily. Citizen science initiatives are fantastic examples of the reciprocal and often symbiotic relationship between research and the public. Essentially, these are research projects where the research is done either completely or at least in part by the general public. I had the pleasure of chatting to Joanne Dempster, an OPAL Community Science Officer from the Glasgow Science Centre.
So OPAL are the Open Air Laboratories. We are an environmental organisation who aim ultimately to get as many people out and recording things about the environment and the natural world as possible. So we have been running in England for the past 5 years and have recently moved up into Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, where we are hoping to get people out and about and taking part in some scientific surveys.
And what interested you in that? Why did you get involved at the beginning, if you remember?
Well, it's a good fun project. For one, it's something I'm really passionate about, is getting people involved and actually doing science. And at school, science was something that I knew I liked, but the way it was taught in school wasn't particularly interesting to me. And I thought, what I really want to get involved in the future and in my career is actually making a difference to the way science is taught and making it more about practical stuff and doing science out in the field where it actually happens, rather than just being told about it by a teacher in the classroom.
So you in all these projects, and you mentioned citizen science, what are the main benefits, or what do you think is the best things about getting citizens to bring the science, bring the data to you, and what are the sort of main benefits of that?
There's always two sides to that question. So there's the side of the scientist coming out from the scientific point of view. In terms of data collection, you're not going to get a bigger workforce than the general public. And you can collect so much more information by opening it up to them than you could by asking the scientific community. So in terms of getting the amount of data we get, we've had over 55,000 surveys done in England in the 5 years that it was going there, and it's still going. And that amount of data is something that you really would never achieve as scientists. The flip side of that is getting general public involved in science is a great way of opening up young people's ideas of what's available in terms of the job market, and just engaging people in science, letting them know that it's actually happening in their country, in their region, even in their city, and making it something that's more personal to them rather than just something that's done by guys in lab coats, something that they'd never be able to reach.
Yeah, sort of breaking down the barriers of how the public sort of would maybe tend to perceive academics as these stuffy lab coaty types. And
quite often I go into schools and the first question I'll ask is, so put your hand up and tell me what you think a scientist is. And inevitably you'll get lab coats, goggles, chemicals. Quite often you also get white hair, glasses, beard as well. And then to turn that around, and at the end you say, so what does a scientist do? And they say, oh well, you're out in wellies, you've got your waterproof on, you're collecting samples, you're looking at animals. Quite often it's just about watching things. So yeah, it makes science much more accessible to do it out in the field with people like that.
Obviously you do the citizen science all around the city, but are there any specific advantages gained from going to those sort of less advantaged communities?
From the community point of view, definitely. You're reaching a different demographic that, again, the people in these disadvantaged communities that we're trying to reach wouldn't necessarily have considered science anywhere near as much as those who potentially have a father or a mother who are already in science in some respect. You quite often will only, when you're young, consider careers that you are familiar with. So teachers, because you're around them all the time, or your parents' careers. So in that respect, we're reaching younger people and showing them science as a career option. On the other respect, you're also going out to areas that you wouldn't necessarily have had much science done in the past. So in disadvantaged communities, you're likely to get park areas or brownfield sites, or sites that generally science wouldn't have been done a great deal. So you're reaching a different area geographically as well as community-wise.
So the OPAL project not only benefits researchers by providing them with access to unprecedented amounts of data, often from unknown or overlooked areas around Glasgow. It can also give Glaswegians from all walks of life first-hand experience of what science is really like and how it relates directly to them. On a smaller scale, projects like OPAL can really make science and the benefits of science tangible for the general public. This is crucial to challenging the myth of the stuffy academic and opening up opportunities for the people of Glasgow to engage in science. But applying this on a larger scale requires a little more oomph. The OPAL project is just one of many that are working in partnership through the Glasgow City of Science project, also based within Glasgow Science Centre. Dr. Susie Mitchell, Director of Glasgow City of Science, was kind enough to join us and share her thoughts on the project and the benefits of such a large partnership for both research and the public that it serves.
So we're based within Glasgow Science Centre, but we cover Glasgow and the west of Scotland. And the whole idea of City of Science is about sort of different partners from different sectors all getting together to work together in partnership to raise the profile of science and innovation within Glasgow and the West for the benefit of economic growth and to improve quality of life. So that could be through sort of improving skills development, sort of education, or just to raise the profile, I suppose, of our capabilities, our joint capabilities, so as a collective within the Glasgow City region to attract new investment, either inwardly or from further afield.
So why is that? So that's obviously a big goal of this, and so I take it OPAL as one of these partners that you...
So OPAL is one of our nearly, we've got nearly 60 partners now, and importantly, if you look at the partner list on the website, what you'll see is that it's quite an eclectic sort of mix of partners, so from the public sector to business, but also the creative industries. And I suppose the sectors that we're sort of focusing on are very much reflective of the economic development priorities within the Glasgow City region, like low carbon renewables, the green agenda is massive, and it obviously will be for next year. We've got Green Year next year. But also the creative industries is a key industry sector in Glasgow, and so we're looking at kind of creative ways of utilising the creative industries to support our objectives of raising the profile of science. That, I mean, there's a lot of, within it itself, within the creative industries, there's a lot of science obviously within digital and, you know, sort of digital technology and product design and all that sort of thing. We've got the art school, for example, but also it's how do you use the medium of film and television to promote the science agenda, whether that's science education or whether that's just informing people about sort of scientific issues or green issues. So that's something that we're, you know, I'm really keen to sort of explore in terms of, you know, let's not just go down the sort of traditional route, for example, of science education. How can we use the creative industries to, you know, either bridge opportunity gaps or to kind of promote a particular agenda. Projects like that are really important because it's how do you translate science and scientific concepts again through the creative industries and media and new media, and again sort of just thinking slightly more sort of laterally. And what that does is it doesn't just engage with those already engaged in science, it engages with media students, you know, and others to sort of think about sort of scientific concepts or their how they might tell a story of science in their own. It's also sort of imperative that we hook up with people like the City Marketing Bureau, sort of the tourism sector. If, again, if you look on our website, you'll see that tourism is one of our key sort of economic sectors. So it's not about just the obvious sort of going to universities and sort of big, sort of business that are involved in science and engineering. It's also about how do you change or transform the cultural identity of a place And you're only going to do that if you try and sort of reach, again, different populations, potentially through either the creative industries, through telly, you know, filmmaking, or, you know, through sort of city marketing and tourism, and really promoting Glasgow, yes, as a city of culture and arts and architecture, but also this sort of, you know, strong capability in science and engineering. So that's another thing that we're doing, kind of working with those partners to try and sort of leverage. They know it, it's within the museums. You go to the museums and it'll tell you that, but you know, if you look at some of the sort of marketing material that comes out, in my mind, it just it doesn't make enough of Glasgow being a city of science.
Glasgow City of Science is involved with a range of workshops with various benefits for the people involved. For example, Glasgow Digital Makers is a coding and digital skills workshop designed to be inclusive to young people of all backgrounds, not just kids who already know how to code. This was made possible due to a collaboration between Glasgow City of Science, the NHS, an investment bank, Young Scot, the SQA and Coder Dojo, which is managed by Craig Steele.
What we did was we looked at the policy landscape. So we looked at the skills investment plans coming out of Skills Development Scotland, and we said, right, what is the ICT plan telling us? Well, the ICT plan is telling us that, yeah, there are a lot of kind of middle-class affluent kids sort of coming through. How do we diversify that pipeline? They talk about diversifying and inclusion and all that sort of thing. And that's a general issue for all kind of industry sectors. So how do we sort of redress that balance and try and dispel some of the myths as well? And there's also, there's a gender gap as well. We've talked about this before in science. So that's another kind of policy issue. And so there were kind of recommendations on the back of that report. Now, that's something that we feel in City of Science that we should be up on, and that, you know, so we can sort of go to people like Craig and say, right, this recommendations report, this evidence-based report has come out of government, it's the best we've got. If you want to access that funding, then you need to be, we need projects that are more inclusive in their report, that directly target specific young people, that have an industry base, which is really important. And one of the things I didn't say earlier was that when Craig was developing that lesson plan, and he always does this anyway, irrespective of the project that he's working on, he makes sure that industry are involved, because he wants to teach young people specific skills that actually will chime in the real world. Mm-hmm. So it's applied, it's stuff that, you know, it's entrepreneurial thinking, it is digital skills, but it's also those kind of softer skills. So he makes sure that industry look at his lesson plans and say, yeah, actually that's the kind of thing that we would be looking for. One of the other partners actually in that project that I failed to mention as well is the Scottish Qualifications Authority. So they mapped the lesson plan that Craig produced to, or probably Claire actually, well, both together in the team, Coder Dojo as a whole, that they produced to a tech qualification, so that the young people aren't just coming out with the experience of, you know, sort of social interaction and those kind of digital skills, using the Raspberry Pis, all that sort of stuff, but they also, they're on their way to a sort of specific technology qualification. So it's just an informal route to, again, the same endpoint, which is a technology qualification, but if their school isn't so up on that, or they just felt that it wasn't for them, you know, that particular teaching style just didn't grab them or what have you, sometimes it can take for something really creative like Coder Dojo to suddenly just think, you know, to grab young people and think, wow, actually, I can totally see the application for digital for something, you know, real life.
Our aim in this podcast is to investigate the intersection between science and public perception. We're trying to build you a picture of what science outreach looks like outside of what you see on TV and in museums. The last two interviews brought us close to understanding the full picture, but we felt like we were still missing something vital, the why behind it all, and so we phoned up a few friends of ours for help. So welcome and thank you all for coming. We'll start by introducing ourselves. I'm Josh Marsh, I'm with The Gist, and you may hear me occasionally jump in to ask a question or try to redirect the conversation a bit.
My name is Zara Gladman, I run the Bright Club Comedy Night in Glasgow, and I also work for Glasgow Science Festival.
I'm Kevin O'Dell, I'm one of the co-organisers of Café Scientifique in Glasgow.
I'm Ian Scott, and I run, or I'm the president of Glasgow Skeptics.
And I'm Emily Steinmark, and I'm with The Gist as well.
Fantastic. So on to our prompt for today's discussion. Science communicators can be seen as wardens of the bridge between science and the public.
Here, we aim to explore specifically why, in both pragmatic and abstract terms, we maintain this bridge. So we'll start with the million-dollar question, which is, why is science communication important? Be blunt.
Well, I think it's important for the public to hear about some of the amazing research that goes on in our universities. You know, our taxes are going towards the research, and there's some really exciting stuff going on that people have no idea about. I think it's good that people are well informed. So that's one reason. I also think it's good from a sort of personal development side of things for the scientists to practice communicating and sharing what they do with the public effectively. Public engagement and science communication are ways for them to do that. There's a whole host of reasons. I don't know if anyone else wants to chip in.
Well, I think that in the media, quite often, then there will be some sort of a rudimentary and quite basic explanations of the recent happenings in science, and quite often they'll be, if not wrong, then at least not quite the full picture. And if people are interested in that, then they can go along to sort of science communication events and find out more, and perhaps in more nuance as well. One thing about the media, I suppose, is that often the messages that are given out are quite conflicting about what cures cancer, also causes cancer, you know, the very next week. And quite often I think that people can get demotivated by that and wonder what science really is all about. And, you know, one week they're saying one thing, one week they're saying the next, a different thing, rather. And so going along to science communication events can sort of elucidate the process and can sort of clear up some of these difficulties in...
Do you sort of draw a distinction between what happens in the media and science communication? Because you kind of explain them as separate things a little bit.
Mm.
I think part of the issue is that it's to get around part of that, the problem that Ian was saying. If the public can get direct access to scientists and get their opinion from them without going through intermediates like the media of all various descriptions, at least they can kind of find out for themselves whether they think the science is the right thing to do or not the right thing to do. Because as Zara was saying, they're paying for all of this, and they want at least at some level some kind of return on the investment they're putting in. So I think giving the general public access to scientists, people actually doing the research, is generally a good thing.
Yeah, and the media and journalists aren't necessarily trained in science. They might not have a science background. So I guess if you can get the news, like Kevin said, directly from the scientist, then you know that it is more likely to be accurate.
Yeah, but I mean, you also have this problem that within the scientific communities there's very rarely full consensus on something. You get bits and pieces, and things might develop very slowly, and it can be quite a long time before we know whether stuff we are thinking about is true. It's actually true. So maybe it is important to have someone there to kind of pick up on the things that we are now getting to know and to communicate it efficiently instead of bits and pieces that we can't piece together ourselves if we're not doing science ourselves.
So a lot of what you guys are saying is kind of jived with one of the themes that I encountered fairly consistently when I was researching this topic, which is decision making, and that's with regard to business or policy or kind of like everyday life sort of thing. Obviously knowing science is going to be useful when you're making decisions about science, but what about understanding scientific thinking? And here I'm talking sort of about the scientific method, but also the ability to think critically and be rational. So what role, if any, does science communication have in that?
I think quite a lot. I mean, Glasgow Skeptics, which is now just over 5 years old, you know, started up 5 years ago, and it was very much about science and pseudoscience and debunking things like homeopathy and aliens and psychics and all that sort of stuff. And has moved sort of away from pseudoscience or debunking through to including general sort of science talks and then into science and public policy and that sort of stuff. And so they are sort of, we found, I think, that they are self-reinforcing. People who have come along to science talks and also talks about pseudoscience, and they've just had a general open-mindedness. They have also come along to political events, and, you know, for instance, we hosted what I think was the largest independence debate hosted by a neutral organisation. And, you know, I was able to encourage, you know, the audience of 400 people, most of whom had never been to a Glasgow Skeptics, a science communication event before, to
not trust any of the politicians on the stage, especially the ones that they already agreed with, which was, I think, something that wouldn't usually be said. But then a lot of those people, started coming back to the actual science communication events afterwards. So it was very much, there was a feedback between the two of them. And so you'd get people who came along for the scientific method to some events and then became more engaged in the politics of it, and vice versa. I think that that could be something to build on.
I think quite often one of the most important things about to get across in a kind of scientific methods sense is that there's not necessarily an answer to something. That if one of the debates we've had, which kind of fits in a little bit with what Ian was just saying, was about health in a Glasgow context, where Glasgow, for most of the preventable diseases, has the kind of worst record in Europe. And there isn't an answer. There's not one magic thing that politicians or anyone else can do. But there are probably 10 or 20 different things that might contribute. But it's really hard to... It's kind of getting across that it's really hard to pull out several things that have a small effect rather than one thing that has a big effect. So in these really complicated science debates, something like the Glasgow effect, you need to get across that it's not easy to tease out small but significant things. And I think that's kind of one of the messages that quite a lot of our talks, I suspect, some of the Glasgow skeptics topics kind of get across. So I think that the expectation is that there is an answer to everything, and that there just isn't quite often. I think that's quite an important message to get across.
Yeah, well, just off that, actually, back at the beginning of the year, we did have very much more a science talk than usual about cancer, cancer, in quote marks. And the speaker, Dr. Vicky Forster, who I think is at Newcastle, and she is a survivor of childhood cancer herself and went on to research it, she was explaining how, obviously, cancer is not one disease. There are many different sorts of cancers. And then within sort of liver cancer, even, there's so many different variations, different genetic varieties, etc., and that there are, thousands and thousands of cancers, which, is not usually conveyed very well. I keep going on about the media, but, there's this one thing called cancer, and we're going to find a cure for it. And that was a really good talk in that regard.
I've been chatting to Jamie Gallagher about this as well, as part of this podcast, and I've been chatting to my co-head of the GIST, Timothy Revel, about this topic as well to kind of prepare myself. And one of the things that we were talking about was whether critical thinking from science communication or getting critical thinking from science communication is really the most practical way to teach people about critical thinking, or to get them to ask critical questions. Because so I know that at Skeptics you do a lot of more political events, and you just talked about that. But maybe the sort of critical thinking or the conclusions that you use the scientific method to draw are a little bit, people don't really see it relate too much to their everyday lives. Perhaps it's a critical thinking within sort of the humanities or critical studies or whatever that people tend to find more useful. For that sort of thing, like their everyday lives, when they have to evaluate what people say on TV, what the politicians say, and so on. Maybe if Kevin, you stand up there and talk about fruit flies and whatever, and there's a guy in the audience thinking, well, that's all well and good, but how am I supposed to use this when I'm chatting to my counsellor? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sort of makes sense. I thought fruit flies might be victims of discussion at some point. But so I did a Cafe Sci evening. So it's genes and behaviour was kind of my subject. But we brought fruit flies into that. And you just need to put things in context and try and point out that things are relevant, more relevant, and so on. And there are some quite amusing stories that I probably won't repeat now about what fruit flies can get up to and how interesting it can be. But it's all about putting it in context, I think. And all of the... There was a comment earlier about whether the science is interesting or not. It has to be interesting to the people that are doing it, otherwise one would imagine that they wouldn't bother to do it in the first place. So there should be an element of them trying to convey to any audience why what they're doing is interesting, or even if it's just pursuing knowledge or whatever. One of the best talks we had was somebody who, I can't remember their name now, but they came up from London, and they'd won a national award for public engagement. And they were a nuclear physicist, which is not the easiest thing to get across. But he was absolutely fantastic. And whilst the immediate topic of what he was talking about wasn't relevant, wasn't immediately relevant, as I can see it, to my everyday life. It was just fascinating what he could or couldn't do, and how we got into a kind of quite an abstract world, and some really good questions from the floor, because most of our event is about questions from the floor. So lots of people who probably knew even less about nuclear physics than I did were asking some really good questions. So it can work. I think it's all about putting it in context of some description or other.
Yeah, I think a big part of science communication is trying to show or convey the relevance of your science to the people that you're communicating to. And it can be difficult, but we did an exercise with PhD students recently where we got them to take a postcard, and they had to write down the title of their PhD on the postcard, but as if they were speaking to a five-year-old. And it was quite a tough exercise, but really useful, because people were able to kind of take a step back from their really specific, complex research and really kind of condense it down into the basics. And it's really important that you do that when you're doing science communication events, to kind of show the relevance.
Without talking to audiences like your five-year-olds.
That was an extreme example, but you don't want to patronise people, but you want to. It depends on the level that you're working at, but it's important to try and make links with things that people can identify with.
I think that maybe the role of critical thinking itself necessarily, talking nonsense, but might necessarily vary depending on, what sort of field that the talk, assuming it's a talk again, is focusing on, and perhaps how esoteric it is. So for instance, if I was recently at a talk on about the Higgs boson, and really it was an excellent talk, but really all the speaker could do was to sort of take us through a story, a narrative of explaining everything bit by bit, and you know, there's not really a moment there where you think, hang on a sec, because it's something which is so, you know, so esoteric, as I said. Whereas if it's a talk on something from sociology, psychology, maybe even some bits of biology, people are presumably more likely to have some sort of preconceptions and some prior knowledge. And so if there's a talk about gender differences, for instance, then people maybe incorrectly might think that they know more, and that they can more, they're more ready to, you know, to say, hang on a second, let's think about that a bit more. So I suppose critical thinking in and of itself, and where the part that has to play in an event, is perhaps dependent on the type of subject being looked at. So
if you wanted to kind of press this critical thinking thing,
mm-hmm.
are you saying that you would have to consider what topic your talk was on? Like, would a gender studies talk be better for critical thinking in the audience than a Higgs boson's talk?
I suppose it would depend on a few things. I think that some things are, when you are looking at societal issues more than esoteric physics, I suppose, for instance, then there will be more, there might be more public engagement in that sort of discussion than there could be otherwise, actual sort of proper questioning what's being explained in a hard science talk.
On the other hand, though,
I
do remember a very excellent Glasgow Skeptics talk not that long ago about the dark universe,
mm-hmm.
that had some very critical questions from the audience.
Oh yeah, but that's Steve for you.
But I think he kind of he echoed a little bit of what people around the room were thinking.
Yes, so
I'm going to stop. Do you want to give like a brief what that was about?
Sorry,
what
we're
talking about?
let me see actually. So what was it about? With the talk itself, or
well, so it was a woman who was she's studying astrophysics, and she was talking about dark matter, and she was kind of giving these very qualitative descriptions of it and how they could understand it, because she was, I guess, trying to really communicate it to an audience that she assumed had no prior knowledge, and maybe it's because they're Glasgow Skeptics audience or whatever, but they're very quick to say, we would actually like to know exactly how we measure this, in a very good, I think, like example of critical thinking. I thought, even though he was a little bit rude.
Yes, so it was Dr. Catherine Haymans from the University of Edinburgh, and She did give a very good talk. At one point, I do remember she points out that there were two images. I can't quite remember what, I think it was to do with gravity, where we saw gravity and where we saw, or didn't see something else. And there was no sort of analysis presented, just look how well these line up. And one of the audience members sort of said, well, he was quite unimpressed, and did start asking quite a lot of questions. And no, so I suppose, no, I take your point. But having said that, I suppose, maybe there would be, maybe it's more about the sort of group discussions which could go on from after that. I don't know. But I think that some topics can perhaps get a bit more heated than others. We've never had somebody storm out of a room, for instance, to talk about physics. Not yet, anyway, but we'll see.
So on that note, I'm going to move to another topic, and it kind of bounces off of what you were talking about with evolution and stuff like that. Science occasionally provokes controversy with people who hold various beliefs. Examples of this are evolution, climate change, abortion, things like that. And these topics have been debated to death, and I'm not interested in addressing those arguments in this episode. What I want to focus on is when the role of science communicator becomes persuasive, how does that change the game?
I'm not entirely sure that the role of a science communicator is to be actively persuasive. There's lots of evidence, if you look at some of the stuff the Wellcome Trust has come up with, of who, so my background's in genetics, so I tend to kind of follow those kind of debates. And if you talk about genetically modified plants, you talk about gene testing, all that kind of thing, generally the people that know more about it are more in favour. So if you, in a sense, if you are just more informative without even biasing, perhaps biasing is the wrong word, but without being overtly positive, you still tend to get people moving in your direction, if that makes sense. Because by being informed about it, by understanding it better, you're not as overwhelmingly negative, because most of the negative things have sort of been addressed. I'm not saying it's all perfect and that there aren't other arguments, but generally the more informed people are, the more supportive they are of their science stuff. There's quite a lot of evidence for that. I believe.
Yeah, we had an event at the Science Festival this year, and it was a debate about renewable energy, and we had scientists working in that field, and then we had some people from some campaign groups who were opposed, and there were people in the audience who accused the scientists of being biased because they were actually working, you know, in that field. But the scientist said, well, you know, I've been working in this field for 40 years, you know, it's my area of interest. I don't know, like,
I mean, it's maybe also the case that the people that are then very sticking to their guns about, they're not going to take the word of the scientist as, you know, they're not going to take it seriously, or perhaps people that they just have decided, right, they're not there to engage with the evidence, they're not there to hear what they have to say, they're there to voice their own opinion, and really no other reason. So, I mean, maybe there isn't even a persuasion element to it, because those people are probably not going to be persuaded.
So, on to our next topic. Science communication often takes the form of what people term infotainment. Are we really communicating what we need to? How do we both engage the public without diluting the message?
Well, I guess you need to be clear what your aim is when you're doing your science communication. So, if you're speaking to a group of school children, are you trying to inform them about you know, the cutting-edge research that your university is doing, or are you trying to get them interested in science on a basic level? Whereas if you're you know, trying to impress someone who might fund your research, you probably want to put the emphasis on the, you know, very specific, more complex research that you're doing. So I think that's the most important thing you need to think about before you then take it forward.
Is there a segment of the population that you think the adult population that we're targeting that aren't already engaged with science?
Yeah, well, the adults, I think, are quite a neglected demographic in science communication. There's so much stuff for school kids, but when you're an adult, I don't know, it's a lot harder to reach these audiences. So Bright Club, the comedy night, was set up down in London, and it was set up with a specific aim of targeting this neglected demographic. I think it was aged 25 to 40 was their target audience, and they thought if we take science into comedy clubs, and pubs, then that's more likely to engage people of that demographic. And that's exactly what Glasgow Skeptics are very effective at doing, pub politics and pub science, and same with Café Scientifique. It's, if you want to engage people, you can't expect them to turn up at your university or lab. You need to go out into the places where people already are. So,
yeah, I think having neutral, what appears to be a neutral venue, is really important.
Yeah.
With beer.
It can help.
Beer can help, certainly. we do have beer at ours as well.
Well, I was just thinking, it reminds me of something that I was reading today about in India, Narendra Nayak, who is actually, I think he's the president of the Federation of Indian Rationalist Associations, and we actually had him, Glasgow Skeptics had him speak 3 years ago now. And so what they do is, so in India there's a big problem with superstition and god men and god women and people feigning supernatural abilities and using this to extort money and power and influence. And so what they do, I suppose, is, it's a bit of infotainment. They attract people by demonstrating, by doing the same sort of magic tricks as these charlatans would do. And then they go on to explain, how the trick is done, and they deliver their proper message. And they are quite clear that, when they are training these people up to be able to demonstrate how the tricks are done, that it's not just about entertaining people, but it is also about, it's not just about training up people who are good at entertaining people, but it is also important to be good at educating people about how, about the science behind the tricks, how it's all done. And so I suppose if the attainment part of that infotainment gets people in and then you inform them, then that's fine, as long as, I suppose, as you said, you don't lose that information part of it.
It sounds almost like a bait and switch where you have the detainment part for them, and then you quickly reverse and teach them something.
Oh no, I'm learning.
But like, infotainment doesn't have to be a bad word. I don't think. I mean, Bright Club. There's certainly a big entertainment bit of it. That's kind of at least that's the main part. And I think, even a podcast is also entertaining. You put it on because you want to, and all of these things. It's not like school that you go just to get information.
Well, what I was going to say was, I think teaching should be like that as well. I think that teaching's just at one end of the whole spectrum, if you like. And certainly when we are teaching here, if I give a 50-minute lecture and at some point I don't get anyone to laugh in the entire 50 minutes, at any point whatsoever, then I would be quite disappointed. I think it's really important as part of that teaching has that as well. Now, it's not that you have to be hysterically funny or something. Part of it's just putting things in context, making things relevant.
So when I think about science communication, I generally think about magazine articles and BBC pundits. Each of your organizations performs or participates in science communication that is sort of less traditional than that. What do you think that brings to people that the BBC pundits don't?
I would say in all of our cases, the thing that the opportunity you have that you do not have by you can have alcohol whilst watching the BBC. but you actually meet the people that are doing the work, whether and the chance to ask them questions in various contexts. We are variants on the same broad kind of theme in that, and that's partly going back to what Zara was saying earlier, that you realise that at least in most cases that scientists haven't got major personality disorders that mean that's why they are scientists, and therefore they're pretty ordinary people who just are really interested in something that actually they is in the end very interesting as well. So I think giving them that opportunity to communicate with people actually doing the work is a real plus. And one imagines that the scientist who's actually talking actually believes in what they're saying and is accurate to what they understand the science is, rather than it actually being filtered through other people and introducing other mistakes. So I think that's the big difference. The only kind of slight downside on that is that generally in all our cases we're still getting people to come to us rather than us go to them quite so much. See, there's still people who've got to be interested enough to turn up because we're not going into their living room and forcing them to listen in some way.
Hijack a pub, would be good.
To a flash mob somewhere and just demand science in a pub.
We are almost coming to the end of our group interview here. And so I think a good note to end on would be for people listening to this, if they wanted to get involved in science communication or just find something interesting to do in Glasgow that involves science, what would you recommend? Of course, there's your own organizations. I'll give you
guys I'll talk on behalf of Zara then, because I would get him. It's the Meet the Scientist events are the best way to kind of do it. If they're working in science and they want to communicate. I think that the events that the Science Festival and the Science Centre put on at various times, where particularly during the festival, where you've got, what do you call your Sunday?
Science Sunday. Good name.
So Science Sunday, for example, where the university is open to lots and lots of people, general public, loads of scientists are there, and they're doing their own kind of show and tell kind of things. And because loads of other things are going on as well, you can just go along and kind of join in. And actually, whether you're fantastic or completely the other end of the spectrum, it doesn't really matter, because you haven't had to organise the day. Somebody does it for you. It's advertised for you. It's organised for you. All you have to do is turn up. So you can kind of just join in. And it's a really gentle way to start, because if it doesn't go well, in the unlikely event that it doesn't go well for you, nobody else is upset about it, because they've not just come to see you. It's a really quite a nice, gentle way of getting involved. And the Science Centre organise similar kind of events from time to time. So quite often that's a really nice, gentle start.
Yeah, the Science Festival runs every June, and it's 2 weeks of events, which includes this big Science Sunday. And Science Sunday is a great place to start. And we're always looking for people, if they've got an idea for an event that they'd like to propose. Actually, the deadline for proposals this year is the 5th of December, so you've got a little bit of time to get your application in. And the Science Festival, we can provide support in terms of helping you find a venue or helping develop any ideas you might have. So that's the Science Festival. I also run Bright Club, which is a comedy night for people who are doing research. So that can be anything from master's level up to professor. And it's a very unique way of doing science communication. And we provide training in stand-up comedy and helping convert your research into jokes. And it's a very rewarding experience. I've had people say that, you know, once you've done a Bright Club, any conference presentation after that is a total dawdle. It takes any fear out of it. There's a lot of camaraderie as well, because you're all, usually it's six people in each show who are all going through this weird experience at the same time. But it's great fun. So I would encourage anyone interested in Bright Club to go onto Facebook and search Bright Club Glasgow, and you can follow us on there. Same on the Science Festival.
So how long do you expect people to talk for?
It's 8 minutes, but that's including laughs. So we encourage you to prepare 6 minutes of material.
7 minutes and 57 seconds.
Yeah. No. It's honestly, I haven't seen anybody die on stage, because it's quite a scientific way of doing comedy, actually, because, you know, stand-up comedians usually, with their material, they keep their material very close to their chest. They don't want to share it with anyone. They're worried about people stealing their jokes. But at Bright Club, we have a training workshop with about 10 different people there, each sharing their jokes with each other and practicing. And we sort of try and test the material over the course of a few weeks. So by the time you're on stage performing it, you know that it has been fully tested in the Bright Club lab for humour.
Is that what you mean by well-researched quips?
Exactly, yeah. So it's all been through the peer review process by the time. So it's a very safe way to do it.
I'd have to say Glasgow Skeptics. At the moment, we're hosting, well, actually, at the moment, and the plan is for the future, we're hosting a weekly free science and politics, I suppose, public understanding events, currently at the Admiral Bar on Waterloo Street, and there's nothing planned for the rest of the year, but we do have quite a lot coming up in 2015, quite a lot of science actually as well, stuff about misuse of statistics in law courts and crimes, etc., asteroid mining. We have an excellent talk on evolution planned. It's an interesting one, I'm sure it'll be about the science and sort of evidence around death and dying, which may be politically relevant as well. And we are hoping to have a very large hustings event for the general election. And so if there are people who are scientifically minded who would like to come along and ask tricky scientific questions of politicians, then that would be a very good time to do it. It's looking like an exciting 2015.
Fantastic. And on that note, thank you guys for coming.
Yeah. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
That was a lot to take in, but I do feel informed, don't you?
I feel like Glasgow is absolutely packed with science.
Indeed. So, dear listeners, we thoroughly enjoyed having you accompany us along this little philosophical tour of science communication, and we really look forward to continuing our science journey with you on our next podcast.
If you're sitting at home right now thinking, well, I do cool science stuff, maybe I should be on a podcast, email us at editor@the-gist.org, and we'll get right back to you. We'd be delighted to hear from you.
That we would. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune in next time.
We have the Glasgow Science Centre, Glasgow Skeptics, Bright Club, and of course, the man who is the glue of all things sci-commy.
We can do it. We can do it.
This is so hard, Emily.
And as it turns out, Glasgow is full of them. We have an excellent branch of Café Scientifique. We have the Glasgow Science Centre, Glasgow Skeptics, Bright Club, and of course, the man who is the glue of all things sci-commy. The one, the only,
okay.
The man,
maybe,
the
maybe
legend,
this is not gonna work.
Jamie Gallagher.
This is obviously not going to work, guys.
Okay.
You done it, Emily.
I'm going to say it with a straight face now.
Okay.